CliffCentral.com.
Yes, sirree, it is a Wednesday morning. It is just after 7 o'clock, and this is CliffCentral.com. We've got Flax and we've got Bulelo, and we're joined by Sean Sanders of Revix.com. Hello, Sean, how are you, dude?
Morning, guys. Morning, Gareth.
Morning. Yeah,
thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. So a bit of an up and down week. About, what was it, 7 days ago when the guys had you on last, things were pretty bullish, and there's been a bit of a pullback. Should we talk about that for starters and then get on to the rest?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same as every other week, right? I mean, sometimes it's up a lot, sometimes it's down. It's been up a lot over the last 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've seen a pretty big pullback. I mean, Ethereum is down about 11% over the last week. Bitcoin's down about 10%. Chainlink's down 14%. So, I mean, it's been a pretty big pullback over the last week. Maybe this is an opportunity to get in. I mean, I think the longer term trend is still very bullish. If you're looking at the crypto market overall, I mean, it's still up 2.5 times since this time last year, right?
Right. And just tell us quickly, are there any that have gone up? Have there been any surprises? Because we have had some interesting new entries to the market. And I know that you don't believe in the ones that don't have their fundamentals in place and the ones that are kind of just a joke, like Dogecoin or, you know, Shibu. But there are some new entries every week. And there's a cryptocurrency for pretty much anything anyone wants anymore.
No, there is. Look, this last week has been a pretty broad market sell-off. I actually don't think there's a cryptocurrency, I stand to be corrected, but I don't think there's a cryptocurrency in the top 20 that has increased in value over the last week. But that just is sort of the nature of this market. I mean, go back to last week's episode and the entire market was up, right? There wasn't a cryptocurrency that was sort of in the red. And this is, I mean, again, if you're positioning yourself as a longer term investor in this space, it sort of pays its dues to say, okay, right, maybe this is the accumulation opportunity that you were looking for. But it is, like, human psychology is fascinating. And we see this all the time at Revix. When the market starts running and really increasing in value like it's done over the last while, a lot of people come in and they come in quickly. And when the market pulls back like this, people end up selling. And it exacerbates the moves in either direction.
Right.
And I think, you know, this is the time with your long-term sort of objective investors. So let's say you are the AI that we're all looking for, this like superhuman AI that's able to view this market. I mean, this is the time when you're meant to say, okay, right, emotion aside, like, let's take a, you know, a position in this market now. Like, this is, you know, you're getting everything at a lower price.
Well, I mean, here's Stink Mina who says, Revix top 10 bundle is always doing the most. But I want to talk a little bit about one of your other bundles, if you don't mind. Can we talk about the smart contract bundle for a second? Because we have discussed this, but it was a little while ago, and I think it's worth going over again. So what is the smart contract bundle, and what is it all about? What are you actually investing in there?
Sure. So, I mean, everyone knows us for our top 10 bundle, right? So you get exposure to roughly around 75% of the cryptocurrency market by buying the top 10 cryptocurrencies. And our top 10 bundle gives you exposure to each of those with one investment.
Right.
So it's sort of like the JSON top 40 or the S&P 500, but for crypto. Now, the smart contract bundle goes a little bit deeper. And this is more for the sort of crypto nuts out there. Mm-hmm. Now we're trying to sort of educate the broader market about this potential. So smart contracts, in a nutshell, are little programs that can do things. I mean, the analogy that's always used is sort of like a vending machine, right? You're able to say, listen, smart contract, this little program, do this. So, you know, should I want to pay somebody at the end of the month and the 25th of the month passes, execute this payment. So if this, then do Y.
Okay.
And that's a very rudimentary sort of understanding of what smart contracts can do. But I mean, at the end of the day, you start looking at all these little applications that are being built on top of blockchains. These are ultimately a whole bunch of smart contracts being clumped together, a whole bunch of if X, then Y events that are creating much bigger opportunities and programs that exist. Now, that was, you know, I guess a very high level overview of sort of what smart contracts are and whatnot. But if you start looking at what blockchains are meant to do, and the idea of blockchains are really to have sort of this peer-to-peer global decentralized network. And there's come blockchains out there such as Ethereum, Solana, Polkadot that are looking to sort of become these blockchain superhighways. Mm-hmm. So they want all the applications to be built on top of them. And they really are competing for market dominance. Now you can go out and you can speculate on some cryptocurrencies like Uniswap, Polkadot, whatever they may be. But a lot of these, Polkadot's a little bit unique because it's got its own blockchain. But a lot of these are building on top of other blockchains. So the success of these projects actually then results in the success of this blockchain, because you'll utilize the blockchain a lot more. So what a smart contract bundle does, and I'm taking now a step back to sort of evaluate that bundle, is we're saying, rather than going out and trying to buy into the individual products mm-hmm. or individual projects in the space, go and buy into the infrastructure. So right. if the success of these projects, you know, occurs, which, you know, it has been incredible, there has been significant growth in this industry over the last while, you've sort of got a picks and shovels approach, using an analogy from the gold rush, where you're then buying into that exact network or that exact project that facilitates other projects. And that's really, in a nutshell, what the smart contract bundle does.
I mean, we don't have the time to be figuring out exactly which cryptocurrency is being used and what kind of application. And nobody except you guys at Revix, frankly, and real, like, full-day, full-time crypto traders and experts can figure out exactly what's going on over there. So you just make it easy for us, because, honestly, we don't know. So if we buy into the smart contract bundle, then we're hopefully buying into the technology and therefore into the value of the cryptocurrencies that are driving it. I like that idea, because I don't have the time to figure out all the stuff you know. How's the return been on that smart contract bundle?
So it has, believe it or not, over the last 5 years, it's almost 15x'd Bitcoin's return as a bundle.
Wow.
And the reason it's done so well is because you've had these sort of new emergents, such as Solana, such as Polkadot, that have gained so much of, you know, the cryptocurrency's market share. I mean, when we spoke last week about how Bitcoin went from being worth about 80% of the entire cryptocurrency market to now only being worth about 45%, that's because of these other cryptocurrencies that are increasing and have increased so much over the last few years. So, I mean, the returns have been outstanding. And, I mean, taking a step back and saying, okay, right, why does this bundle exist? Why did we offer this? Because essentially what we do with this bundle is we say, we're going to give you exposure to the top five largest smart contract-oriented cryptocurrencies. Lots of jargon in that. But essentially, the likes of Ethereum, Cardano, Polkadot, that are looking to create this blockchain superhighway. So instead of you going out and, as you've said, guessing which of these will be a success story, you're able to get exposure to all of them. And that encompasses about 95% of these smart contract-oriented cryptocurrencies. And it's a little theme within the crypto space. So just like you have, say, the technology sector or the resources sector in the stock market, this is a theme within the crypto space. So not all cryptocurrencies are created equal. They all do very different things. I think a lot of people don't know that. And this is essentially a bundle focusing on a very particular group of cryptocurrencies. Sorry, I completely deviated from your question there, Gareth. I'm not sure.
Just in terms of the returns. So I'm just looking at your website right now, because that's the best way for me to figure it out. And the smart contract bundle has had a 1 year change of 712.18% in returns. So that's in the positive. That's very good. Considering your top 10 is like 590%, the payment bundle's 288%. And Bitcoin itself at 250%. That's a hell of a you know, return. That's very nice. That's in a year.
I mean, that's just over the last year, right? Yeah. I mean, when you start looking back to, say, around 2016, which is when we started looking at this data at the beginning, I mean, that's when this looks just absolutely absurd. We actually, we were hesitant to release an article recently, because if you compare the performance of the smart contract bundle to the likes of Bitcoin, it actually looks fake. It actually is so... So it outperforms Bitcoin by so much that it makes the bundle look unrealistic, which is, I guess, a good problem to have, I suppose. But this is really, again, like sort of just talking to a broader audience, saying, you know, smart contracts and smart contract-oriented cryptocurrencies, they are going to be a very big part of the future. If you think about decentralized finance, the entire decentralized finance world exists between three blockchains at the moment. That's Ethereum, Solana, and Cardano. Like, that is it, really. And I mean, to be able to get exposure again to sort of that picks and shovels like approach, where you're not betting on individual projects, but rather the success of the network as a whole, is something that we believe is a good investment thesis.
I mean, I think everybody's kind of convinced. Well, certainly the people that we talk to every week here and the people who you're talking about know what this is. Michael says, for example, if you're sensible and you do your due diligence, crypto will make you very wealthy by 2025. And of course, you mustn't get obsessed with the week in, week out ups and downs of these things. You must look at the overall trajectory. And human beings are not good at this, right, Sean? We're not good at, and Borlello, you know this too. We're not very good at seeing the big picture. We respond to immediate stimuli and we go, oh, well, it's at 60 grand today. It's too much to buy. But it was at 65 grand last week, and it might be at 80 grand at the end of this year. You don't know. It might also drop down to 36 grand. But in the long run, is the overall trend up or down?
Exactly. And I think just taking a step back again from all of this and right turning our attention to the traditional financial world and the economy and all the rest, I mean, you're seeing inflation, and we spoke about mm-hmm. this a year ago, 2 years ago. It's sort of like I told you so moment from all of us.
Yeah.
But inflation's occurring. I mean, you saw the highest, we've got US inflation that's higher than in South Africa. It's the highest it's been in, I forget the exact time period.
40 years.
You know, 7 years.
No, it's longer than
20
that.
Years, yeah.
I think it's 40.
It's crazy.
Because they haven't.
And there's this opportunity. Sorry, guys.
No, they're just borrowing money left, right, and center, and printing money left, right, and center. And it's eventually, all that inflation is, Sean, and I'm no economist, but it is when you have too much money in the system and not enough product. So the price of those products goes up. I mean, that's the most rudimentary way I can describe it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, if you and I were the only people in an economy and I said, well, listen, this pen's worth $1 and we both have $1 each. I mean, there's value then to this pen, right?
Absolutely.
We go and we add an extra $100 each into this economy. We each get an additional $50. All of a sudden, this pen isn't worth as much.
Correct.
So, I mean, it's that idea already around inflation. But now you've seen that happen in the market. And there's this incredible opportunity around, should we see hyperinflation? I don't know what the probability of this. I don't think anyone knows really what the probability of this occurring would be. But should we see hyperinflation, there may actually be no better hedge to that than Bitcoin and Ethereum and some of the other larger cap cryptocurrencies.
Well, we'll leave it at that. You can go along to revix.com. You can sign up for free. Put in, you know, anything, $400, $500. Start today. Verify your ID. Add the funds. Select the bundle of your choice and get involved. And check out that smart bundle contract too. Thanks, Sean. Good to see you, dude.
Awesome, guys. Thanks very much. Cool. Take care.
There's Sean Saunders, Revix.com. You can find out more by going to visit him. A couple of things that were said a little bit earlier, and I wanted to just go back to this quickly. We were talking about watches and time and how important that is. I mean, Zach says here, an expensive watch is a celebration of precision in nano chronograph engineering. If you saw the process behind the Swiss handmade watches, it's worth every cent spent. Well, that's probably why in investment terms, since we're talking about money with Sean, watches are one of those things that also go up in value, right? Tracy mentions the tap and go on credit cards and debit cards are the next target for fraudsters. They walk around with devices that can tap for payments while your card is in your wallet or your handbag. So be careful.
Can I tell you a trick for that?
Yes, go.
What you do is, you know how you have your savings account and then you have what's like in your, gold check account?
Mm-hmm.
Keep your gold check account to like 2-3 grand only, and then keep everything in your savings and just keep transferring. Because if anyone tries to steal your cash, they're not going to get all your cash. They're only going to get what's in your gold check.
Suggestion. Well,
I hope that works.
I mean, for some people, the problem is that they've got a limit on their credit card. I mean, you can set your limit low, right? But then if you suddenly need to spend more than, as you say, 2 grand, which is not out of the question for many people in a month, then you suddenly have to increase your limits all the time and then decrease your limits. And I don't know whether that's a sensible way to go. But maybe you have a credit card that you carry around that has a very low limit, and you have another one that you keep in your wallet that you only bring out when you absolutely need it. It's a good suggestion. We need to think about these things. Because as Lebang said yesterday on the show, there are so many fraudsters going around at the moment. Not a day has gone by in the last 6 weeks where I haven't got an email from someone saying I've won the lottery, or I've got a dead relative in Nigeria who's just left me millions, or here's an invoice, please, please let us know when we can make payment to you for $560,000. It all sounds too good to be true, because it is. And you must not fall for this stuff, please.
You know what you should say to them, Gareth, and because it's true, I believe, in your case, is that you should say, excuse me, stop being racist. I'm not from Nigeria. I'm actually from the West Indies. You know, I have family from the West Indies. It's extremely racist to say we all look the same.
But you see, at the same time, you don't really want to get in a conversation with these people, because the more you talk to them, the more information on you they have, and the more likely that they'll try again to rip you off in the future. But there is this point that someone made about those credit cards. Apparently the limit on tapping is like $500 without a PIN anyway. So unless you put your PIN in, there is an automatic limit on those too. So that's, you can also get those, you can also get RFID proof wallets that actually prevent anyone from tapping while it's in the wallet, because it's kind of insulated, and the clearly you need contact for some of these payments to be made.
Wallets have changed over the years. I remember back in the days, I used to have one of those Velcro wallets with a chain. I would chain it to my pants and then you'd like take the Velcro wallet out and it would have like a money little purse and the chain would dangle for style.
Yeah. I remember.
And now all I have is like world's smallest wallet that just carries cards because I don't carry cash.
Well, so I have the wallet, which is here. So I have all my cards and shit in there, right? And then I've got this thing, which I bought in Europe. It's just a little card wallet. It's thin.
Oh, that's nice.
It's tiny. And you just put a credit card on one side and your ID on the other. So you don't have... Yeah, there we go. And Bolero's got the same thing.
Is that like your going out wallet compared to your everyday wallet?
Well, I don't want to have to... Again, if you lose everything, and I don't lose wallets anymore, touch wood, but I used to in my 20s. I used to lose phones and wallets all the time. But you only really need your credit card and your ID. So the rest of it you can leave at home. You could leave it at home, you know, put it somewhere where it's going to be safe and you won't lose it. And then you just take out that little wallet pouch and then you're sorted.
I also think you need your medical aid card.
Card holder. You just need a card holder. You know, I don't know. I don't get
You don't need cash. But like sometimes when I'm going out and like I'm wearing tight jeans and I don't want to take a wallet, I'll just take my credit card, my ID, and my medical aid card. Because I always have this picture of myself lying dead on the floor and someone needs to know if they can take me to a private hospital.
But Markle, just get a card holder. You don't need a wallet. Don't worry about it.
Here we go. I have a card holder, but it's got all my loyalty cards. How many loyalty cards do you have in there right now? Probably like 600.
Unbelievable.
Take out all your loyalty cards.
I got and zero then probably loyalty cards. My hard train card, my medical aid card.
I bet you there's a Woolworths card in there.
No, my Woolworths card's here. I'm also at Woolworths.
Yeah, exactly. You've got a Woolworths card in there. You've probably got a Checkers loyalty card in there.
No, don't be ridiculous. Why am I shopping at Checkers? Don't be ridiculous.
I have loyalty cards for everyone. I believe in loyalty cards. Wherever it is, I must make cash back.
You can, though. I mean, some people are really good at this stuff, and they actually save a ton of money, man.
Yeah.
So I went and bought some stuff at the shops the other day, just groceries and stuff. Came to, I don't know, just under R1,000. And then the woman's like, do you have your smart shopper card or whatever? I'm like, I don't have one of those. So she takes hers out and taps hers. Now she's getting the
money. She's genius.
So I think that's, I mean, if I'm not going to benefit, she may as well, you know.
Fair dinkum. No. Fair dinkum.
I fill up at the same petrol station using a smart shopper card about once a month to get a free sandwich off it. I mean, it doesn't take you far. You're not going to become a billionaire or smart shopper points, but you will get a free sandwich once a month.
So Bradley's speaking the language that I want here. He's load all your cards on your phone. Can you load your Woolworths card on your phone? I don't think so.
I think there's an app where you actually put all your loyalty cards into the app and it just pulls it up, because really what you need is that barcode or that number or something for people to scan.
Well,
I should look into that.
Okay, so if Bradley's right here, then that's the way to go, because then you don't have to carry any of those around. You just have to have your phone. Perfect. Hein has got a carbon fiber wallet with a money clip. That sounds very classy. I like that a lot.
Ooh, that's awesome. That sounds legit.
Right. Have you seen that new craze where people are taking their credit cards and they send it to some company in South Africa and they take the chip out and then they put that chip into like a solid titanium or silver card.
Yeah.
So now you're tapping with something that's not plastic. And it's the new craze at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Sounds like a unnecessary bullshit thing. Boer Willem,
100% unnecessary.
Boer Willem says, tart jeans, Markle. That's how you...
I've got to be too tart.
Tart. You need to be tart.
I'll go to like the shops and buy normal clothes and then take them to the tailor to make them like a tight, slim fit.
Well, okay.
You got it. I think you got it.
All right. Okay. My spa pensioner's card works well, although I'm not retired yet, says Steve. Steve getting the old people's benefits. That's nice.
Won't that only work like on a Wednesday or something? Isn't there like a pensioner day of the week?
I don't
know. Wednesday?
I don't know. Seamus says, put all your loyalty cards on the store card app. Okay, there's some useful info. These are all first world problems, according to Robin. First world problems. Michael Flax is the perfect Jew with all his loyalty cards, says Carl.
You've got to have loyalty cards.
When Styrian Pikachu says, I got scammed on a loyalty card and had 40K fraud on it. Jeez, that's hectic. All right. Is the effort of loyalty cards is a question for you, Flax, worth the savings? I can never be bothered. There are too many cards out there.
Well, think about it from two points. One, they're going to ask you if you have a loyalty card. So you can just eliminate them asking you by presenting the loyalty card from the very start. And number two, like, look at it as a long-term savings. Like, every time you use that loyalty card, you might get like R2 off an item, or you'll start getting points, and over time, those points add up.
Okay.
Think of it as a long-term investment, not just a R2 on the spot. Think of like R2 every day.
So I'm writing this down because I'm actually going to check out these different apps. There's Mobile Pocket, according to Lenise. She says that's a good one to look at. The store card app, S-T-O-C-A-R-D.
It's like an app for everything nowadays.
I know.
It's where we're going. It's the way to do it.
Would you rather have one app on your phone with all your loyalty cards on it? And then I'll actually subscribe for all these loyalty cards because I won't forget them at home, you know?
I'd love two cards max. One with all my money, drivers, blah, blah, blah. And then the other one for all this other stuff. Loyalty, vaccine is my other one. Let's separate those. And then I just tap my vaccine card wherever I go. You know what I mean? I'd like to live in that
world. Oh, shit. I got to go for my second vaccine shot today. I almost forgot about it.
So exciting.
I'm so excited. I can't wait. It was so easy last time.
Yeah, but then you're fully vaccinated.
Then it wasn't even a thing. I mean, like, I really expected more of a fanfare. I thought they'd at least give me a sucker afterwards, and they didn't. It's a bit upset.
You must make sure they give you a vaccine card, and you must keep that. You see? I didn't know that it was important, and I crumpled it up, and I had to go like diving in the dumpster for it.
Markle, we've moved on now. You can actually, if you go onto the website, you can actually get your certificate with a barcode. So we can do that now. That's something you should do.
They SMS'd me mine, so I've got an electronic version.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. So Lenise also says Clicks used to have the best reward system, but then they changed it. I got all the vouchers in the post and then used them on presents for Christmas once a year. Yeah. That's what I do with my, my bank, app. You know, they've got like a reward system, and then I go on there at Christmas time and I spend it all on like presents for other people. That's the way to go.
I wish I got, and I don't know if it's still a thing, but Voyager miles. Like when I was growing up, to my parents, that was a big thing, Voyager miles. And they wanted Voyager miles whenever they used their credit cards and stuff. And we'd actually use the Voyager miles to like travel.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's or upgrade our seats on planes and stuff.
Yeah. Well, these days, of course, the SAA, who used to be our Voyager people, they're no longer in business. So you can't do that anymore. There are others.
No, you can't.
There are others that still have it. Anyway, I mean, this is all useful stuff, right? I mean, this is really, really handy to know. And if you don't do this stuff, you're missing out on money that could be yours. Anyway, is Michael aware that Mbulelo takes the piss out of his name the entire way through the show? Yeah, of course. He calls you Markle.
Yeah.
We know that.
Doesn't bother me.
Fantastic.
Half my roommates, when they get drunk, they call me Markle.
Markle. All right.
That's how I know they're drunk.
So let's just talk about Donald Trump. He's just sold a hotel in Washington. Now... You know, all these other politicians, they don't have hundreds of millions when they finish being president. So they have to go out and make speeches, and they get paid quite a lot of money to do these things. But we're not talking $375 million in one deal. So Donald Trump just made $375 million in one deal. He sold a hotel in Washington, D.C. to CGI Merchant Group. Nice job. Nice. Yeah.
It's a good deal. We've made a great deal. We've sold the hotel. I'm very happy. I could go retire in Mar-a-Lago. I've got lots of cash. I don't need the money, but what the hell? I got the money. I may use it for the next presidential election. Who knows? I don't need you, Bernie. I don't need you, Joe Biden. Go to hell. I got my hotel. I sold my hotel. What you got?
That's like spot on impersonation of Donald Trump.
It really is.
I bet you. I mean, I'm sure that he sends people, because he's the kind of guy who's petty enough, right? That he would send people he hates letters saying, "I just made $375 million. What did you do today?" He's the kind of guy who'd that.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He is definitely.
You know.
And I'm about that. I'm about that action as well. He's definitely that dude. I mean, there's a lot I disagree with, but he must make people so mad because he's really one at the whole like dude thing as well.
Yeah.
And also, like, now anyone who's very dude, everybody hates, and he's just a dude.
Mm.
Just like super hot lady. So, you know what? I broke up with one. I don't care. I'll marry another one. Break up with her. I don't care. I'll marry an even hotter one. And then I'll be the president. Rich. And then I'll have the biggest reality show of all time. And then my, like.
He's just. And I'll just be president. I'll just be president for 4 years because I can. I won't just beat anybody. I'll beat Hillary Clinton, who's been part of the political machine all of her life. I'll beat her at her own game and show you how useless she is. I mean, that's FU money. That's what that is. That $375 million.
Yeah.
All right. Bulelo, please tell me what happened with these Russian, astronauts, because I don't know the story at all. And I feel like an idiot because everybody else is talking about it on social media.
So it's obviously, it's the international, space station, of course, but the international, guys are the ones that are worried. So Russia did a military, sort of weapons experiment, and some of that debris, they didn't quite really do it according to regulation. Shocker. Russia. I do love Russia and I do love Russians, but you know, they do things anyway. But actually it was a real problem because seven, astronauts were, in the International Space Station, and they had to take cover because, I learned this as I was reading the story, that there's actually bunkers for these sorts of things. They've really thought of everything. So all seven of them had to go into their bunkers. It's these stable bunkers, essentially. Should there be contact with debris and things like this, they have to go and, they have to hunker down, literally.
Oh my God.
This is what happened. And, it was a Russian, and they are not happy. Listen, America's not happy about this at all, and they are letting Russia know that, hey, this ain't it. And obviously there's, I believe there was an Indian astronaut up there, so it's a problem, you can't just release debris out there.
No.
Without telling us anymore.
But the Russians...
Is Russia now firing missiles from space?
Well, no.
The Americans and the Russians have been doing that. They're testing missiles in space. They've been doing this.
From space? Yeah. But surely it should be illegal to take a missile into space?
Why would it be?
There is some space border crossing community or something.
Anything?
Are you saying like Demi Lovato, we must respect extraterrestrials, Michael? Yeah. Is that what you're suggesting we should extend to them? Right.
Are you telling me if I could build a rocket, I need no permits to go into space?
You don't.
I need no visa, nothing.
No.
I can just launch from my garden into space.
Yeah.
But it's
someone has to make a border control for space.
Nobody owns space. That's ridiculous.
but it's some timeshare, Michael. It's not Sun City where Gladys can say, no, we own apartment 3. The aliens from Pluto come and say, hey, what are you guys doing here? Get off our lawn.
No, we need a controller. We need to know who's going into space and who's leaving space and who's still in space.
For what? What for?
The same thing with countries. You pass a border, they know who's in there, how long they've been in there.
We have a list of every person who's ever been to space. It's not a very long list. I mean, it's hard to get up there. You need some very sophisticated technology to make it beyond the atmosphere of the Earth. So why would you need documentation? And who are you going to – like, there's someone at a desk halfway through the stratosphere who's going to be sitting there going, excuse me, please give me your papers so I can stamp them. What for?
Yeah.
No, it's unnecessary.
They should make, like, only one launch pad. They need to start controlling it. Space is the next thing. People are going to be living in space. We need to get it right now.
Flex.
Wait. How big do you think space is that you think – what do you think is going to get overpopulated?
No, space is huge, but we need to know who's there and who needs to come back to Earth.
Why? What for?
Watch, I'm telling you now.
We can't even
20 years.
Flex, we can't even do that on Earth. You know how many
border control for space.
You know how many Zimbabweans live in South Africa? Do you know how many Mexicans live in America? I mean, we can't even. So the Russians fire a bunch of debris into space. Let me tell you something. There is a place in Russia called Lake Karachay, which is a concrete lake. It's a couple of kilometers square big. The Russians put so much nuclear waste into that lake that they had to concrete it over it's made of concrete now. There's no water. There's no fish. There are no animals. If you drink from there, even in the surrounding areas, all the trees are dead because the nuclear waste that they pumped into that lake, and it's huge. It's probably the size of, I don't know, let me think of something that is in Joburg that you could, like Emerentia times five. And it's just...
I was going to go Bruma Lake.
Bruma, exactly. So Bruma Lake times 3.5. Just full of solid concrete because they're trying to contain the radiation in it. The Russians don't care about space. They don't even care about Earth. You're worried about keeping people, making them fill in their documentation before they go to space. It's ridiculous.
Do you know how much fuel it takes to move a kilogram in space, Michael? Space is not the next thing. I know Elon Musk is saying that.
Yeah.
Oh,
the amount of energy it takes.
Guys,
we are going to be living on Mars soon.
We've got to stop this because we've got to get to blind history, or as Michael would say, blonde history. So that's coming up next. Flaxi, thank you very much. Nice to see you again, dude. And always good to catch up with you. Bulelo, we'll see you tomorrow morning. And it is time for the first episode of the next season of Blind History, which is brought to you, of course, by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. I'm really excited to bring you this latest episode. And today, it's all here for you. Russia was a medieval backwater in the 1600s. Primitive, tribal, dark, and depressing. It was a vast expanse filled with superstition and feudalism, but just one man would be responsible for its spectacular transformation. The Russia that would enter the modern era and the Enlightenment was led by a mustachioed, worldly giant who dragged the largest country of Earth out of the quagmire and towards Western progressivism. In so doing, he forged an empire of culture, sophistication, and drunkenness. From that point in history until today, Russia has remained central to geopolitics, a fact that would have brought a smile to the face of Peter the Great. Well, Blind History Season 6 has to open up with a big one. And we did this with Idi Amin, so I'm going to just launch straight into it. This is his title, right? This is what he called himself. By the grace of God, the most excellent and great sovereign emperor, Pyotr Alexeyevich, the ruler of all Russias, of Moscow, of Kiev, of Vladimir, of Novgorod, of Kazan, Astrakhan, and Tsar of Siberia, sovereign of Pskov, the great prince of Smolensk, of Tver, Yugorsk, of Perm, of Vyatka, of Bulgaria, and others, sovereign and great prince of the Novgorod lower lands, of Chernigov, of Ryazan, of Rostov, and he goes on and on and on, and then it says, and many other states and lands, western and eastern, here and there, and the successor and sovereign and ruler. His name was Peter the Great of Russia. But long before any of these titles were attributed to him, he was born to his father, the Tsar, and he wasn't expected to be Tsar when he was born. I'm Gareth Cliff. Anthony Meader is my co-host. Welcome to another season of Blind History. Peter the Great.
Sure, hero villain.
You were kind of more interested in Peter the Great than I was, but you've also given me a book by Simon Sebag Montefiore, who we interviewed in the last season. And
on the Romanovs.
Yeah, the book on the Romanovs, which was a useful source on all of this stuff. This guy had a hell of a life.
He lived massively fast, died at 52, drank himself to death possibly, but he was third in line on the Romanov throne because it was his grandfather, Michael. Mm-hmm. And then his dad, Alexei. And then
there were two in between, who we'll talk about in a second, two half-brothers.
Oh, yes, that's right. It was a little bit more complicated than that. But ultimately, in the end, I have to say that he deserves the name The Great. You know, we've done a lot and covered a lot of people in history. And we talk Julius Caesar, we talk Augustus, we talk Alexander the Great. Massive energy. He's just another version of Alexander the Great. What he accomplished in 52 years is more than anybody can accomplish in 100 years.
Yeah, you know, I often look at these The Greats and I think, well, you have to have broad agreement over calling someone The Great, and it has to be over at least a period of 200 or 300 years before they get that title. And there are some who may still get that title one day. People may refer to, you know, Bismarck as The Great one day, but he still lived at a time where we have photographs. Napoleon has never been called the great because I think maybe it's still too soon to tell. There are possibly other people who may eventually ascend to that title, but Peter the Great, without him, Russia would undoubtedly be a very backward and very primitive place and would never have been incorporated into Europe and the Western world as it has become. Certainly, it wouldn't be as grand or as impressive in places like St. Petersburg if it weren't for this singular man.
And you can actually see when you're reading the stories around the time, I mean, Russia, and actually even today, Russia's a wild place. For him, being brought up is really hard. I mean, if psychologists and psychiatrists had to look at his stability or instability, it's he witnessed his family being thrown off the first floor at the Kremlin. All of those things that he witnessed in the power struggles to try and maintain some sort of control. And I suppose to put it in a brief summary, the challenge came in is that his dad had two wives. And that's the succession from the first wife, and then there's a succession from the second wife. And I suppose it played out in his favor in that the male heirs from Alexei's first marriage, they weren't particularly strong. One was like half an idiot, and the other one was very sickly.
Yeah.
But the sister was phenomenal.
Sophia. Well, let's start with his family. So he was born to this incredible but low-born woman whose name was Natalia. And she seems to have been a major influence on his life. She became very religious later on in life. And people have written about her variously as being, you know, a bit of a nutcase in some ways, but also as this conservative and very stabilizing factor on him. He was born apparently with good health, with his mother's dark Tartar eyes and a little bit of auburn hair, they said. But they used to make icons of the czars back in those days when they were born. So you have an exact measurement of what size he was as a baby, painted into this icon, which is the portrait of his namesake, St. Peter, the Apostle of Jesus.
Talking a little bit about his mom, you know, she came up from a poor background, but she had the opportunity to be exposed to the Western world through her minders and the people that looked after her. And this made a big difference in Peter's life.
Right.
And as he was growing up, there was a German sector which was very close to where they were sort of exiled. We maybe can unpack that a bit just now, but he sort of frequented them. And that's where the seed started to be planted of how he wanted to westernize Russia.
So I just want to quickly give an overview, because people have spent a lot of time in various other histories paying attention to the difficulties of his youth. But it seems to me he also had the opportunity when he was out in the country to really figure himself out and to decide on what he most cared about. So being the son of a czar, it was never that tough for him. But he did get embroiled in a big conflict between his mother's family and the family of the other wife of Tsar Alexei. And what happened was that essentially he was on the throne and then suddenly he wasn't. He was never really in conflict with his half-brother or half-sister at any stage. But he didn't inherit the throne from his father. The eldest of his children, Fyodor, did. And he was, as you said, sickly, you know, vaguely inbred, not a great piece of stock, didn't last terribly long, and died, thrusting young Peter and his other half-brother, Ivan, onto the throne. Ivan was severely physically and mentally disabled and incapable. And the regent was Sophia, his half-sister. But Sophia had conspired to make this happen by essentially getting on top of the Strelsky, how do you pronounce that? Strelsky.
Strelsky, and they were the nobility, yeah.
No, the Strelsky were the army that were loyal to the Tsar.
Okay.
The boyars were the nobility.
Correct.
And the boyars essentially were all for keeping tradition in place, all their privileges. They didn't want too much to change. They were also in league with the Patriarch and the Orthodox Church. And then you had these women again, these powerful women, Natalia, Peter's mother, and his half-sister Sophia, who wanted to keep reforms moving. And the Strelsky became obviously kind of concerned about this. And they were used to some degree because they were told that Peter and his mother had murdered Ivan. So they rode into town and they said, okay, well, we're not going to allow this to happen. And they were presented on the balcony with Ivan and Peter. So they were a bit confused. They thought, well, okay, well, that's the end of our rebellion. And one of the commanders started shouting at them and berating them for their ill discipline. And they decided, oh, hell no, we're not going to tolerate this. So they basically hacked him to pieces in Moscow, in the courtyard. And
And Peter witnessed all of this.
He witnessed all of this, including the murder of his mother's favorite and the guy who'd really thrust him into power, a guy called Artemom Matveev. But that was the end of the first part of Peter's life, and he never forgot all of it. So he didn't tolerate any ill discipline from there on in.
But at that time, then, they basically said to him and his mom, look, you need to go out to, I think that's it's very difficult, Priobras Henskoye. You know, that's a place just outside Moscow.
That sounds, of course, if you and I were driving there, we'd find it.
Yeah, exactly. But he feared for his safety because now Tsar Alexei's first wife's family were basically in control. But, you know, that didn't last too long. Then he started actually getting more control. What happened was he was, in a way, proud of his sister, and he acknowledged his sister as being a very competent ruler,
yes,
Sophia. But he still put her in a monastery, you know, I mean, in a convent,
yeah,
which was actually in Moscow. And then he took over.
That's right. It was interesting that eventually when he took over, he and his half-brother ruled together for a time. Mm. And they both had a throne especially made for them, a two-seat throne, where there was a little cupboard behind Ivan and behind Peter's ear where Sophia could whisper the instructions to them, so that she could make sure that it looked like they were in charge, even though they weren't.
But Peter really didn't defer to Ivan or to Sophia, for that matter. He was still very young, but he spoke his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And when they sent him away with his mom, he never had a proper education that you'd expect of a Tsar.
No.
And interestingly enough, he was self-made. He taught himself in mathematics, shipbuilding, woodwork, all those different things. Everything that he did. He taught himself, which was phenomenal.
And apparently, his handwriting was very childish because he'd never learned to write properly.
Yeah,
and his Greek was bad, and his Polish was bad. But he was a very smart man, undoubtedly. Mm. And you mentioned shipbuilding, but he was properly obsessed with ships.
Yes,
he found an old model ship among his father's possessions on this estate they were exiled to, and became completely enamored of the idea of sailing. It was an English ship, and he used to force his friends and his servants to help him build ships that he would sail on lakes for years afterwards. He became so obsessed that one of the major thrusts of his reign was to develop a proper port for Russia, first in the Sea of Azov in the south and later in the Baltic.
He single-handedly, ultimately, with his team, built the navy, took a port, conquered.
So it started off with war with the Ottoman Empire, and we're not going to go into too much around his battles because a lot of it is kind of boring, and while the Great Northern War was a big deal, there was an empire of Sweden, which was enormous, and the Swedish king had a substantial army, and they had lots of money because they controlled the Baltic.
Yeah.
And there was no other port except Arkhangelsk, which was mostly frozen over. It was so far north.
Up in the way north, yeah.
So if Peter wanted to have this navy, and he was prepared to spend and do whatever was required to have the navy, he had to have a place to launch them from. It failed in the Sea of Azov because eventually the Ottomans retook that.
But that was the Black Sea.
The Black Sea. And he was trying very hard to make alliances in Europe with his grand embassy in order to displace the Ottoman hold on the Black Sea. It didn't really go his way.
And there was the Christian angle as well, the Christian Muslim angle that was at play. And he tried to get support for that,
which, by the way, is still an issue in Russia today. Mm. Eventually, though, he did manage to conquer the Baltic, and he eventually managed to take what was an old Swedish fort and turn it into St. Petersburg, easily one of the jewels of Europe, and got to have his wish, you know, the port that he always wanted. He made alliances with people, including Augustus the Strong of Poland. Augustus the Strong, who was believed to have been called that because he could bend a horseshoe with his own hands. You know, these are the kind of legends.
But also his great nemesis in the Northern War was Charles the XII from Sweden. Mm. And this was a proper tactician, a massive warrior. He was really, really
We forget Sweden at that stage was like the superpower.
It was correct. It was an empire.
Mm.
And Peter, from this dark Russia, broke Charles the XII. And so we talk about Napoleon and we talk about Hitler, how going to Moscow to try to take Russia was stupid.
And this is what Charles tried to do.
Yeah.
He marched on Russia. Obviously, your supply lines are stretched to the limit. Plus, Russia has millions of miles of people who live in little villages, and the Tsar was able to just recruit them at will. He could levy an army of 100,000 men in a day or two, which, you know, poor little Sweden, I say poor, they were rich at the time, but they didn't have that kind of population.
Yeah, that was his Waterloo.
Yeah.
Charles XII. So that was one of the great accomplishments, the Northern War, conquering the Swedish Empire. And, and from there, it was downhill for that.
The Swedes. They've never recovered.
No, they never recovered. And then suddenly he's got access to the Baltic. Yeah. And ultimately, you know, even now today, you've got the Black Sea. But I think that was his, the next lineage that started taking control down south. And he didn't like the limelight. So that's why when Ivan was around and still going strong, Ivan did all the administrative stuff. It might be some of these events that you had to partake in. He never did any of that.
Yeah.
He hated the necessary events that were always thrust upon a Tsar. He just liked to do his own thing so he could just sit back and watch. Yeah. And
he used to often tell his friends to take command over him. In other words, that he would just be one of the ordinary soldiers and he would... You'd take up ordinary jobs like being the drummer boy in the army or, you know, being an ordinary shipbuilder. And he, in fact, during his Grand Embassy, which was one of the most famous events of his reign, he took a tour of Europe, which until then had been unheard of by a ruler. Most rulers just stayed in their country for fear of coups and for fear of being displaced and replaced. But he was unafraid. So he took to Europe, went and visited every major center in Europe. And very often did it incognito, you know, called himself Peter Mikhailovich or something.
Correct.
And would just breeze around town drinking with his mates. They were quite a rowdy bunch, though.
Yeah, I think maybe we should paint the picture a little bit on one. On there was like over 200 of the drunken synod.
So he called it the College of Cardinals.
The College of Cardinals. And they came up with all funny names to each other, like Big Dick.
Yeah.
Honestly, they had really... Yeah. Descriptive names, and they were always drunk. And if you didn't drink and you couldn't keep up, then you'd have to drink a massive bottle of something. And a lot of his ministers died of what Peter called the disease, which was alcohol poisoning.
Yeah.
And his daughter got married to, I think, a prince from Austria, and he died a week after the celebrations of alcohol poisoning. So it was, these guys were serious drinkers.
Well, they used to drink in London when he was stationed there. He was busy cozying up to William III of England.
His hero.
Who was also Prince of Orange and who commanded this incredible fleet of Dutch ships and had a handle on trade. And Amsterdam was one of Peter's favorite places to go. Amsterdam and Venice he was obsessed with, which is why he later founded St. Petersburg and had them dig canals and try to make it the Venice of Russia. Which he believed was one of the greatest compliments he'd ever been paid. He was obsessed with building and gardening and putting up fortresses and ships and all this kind of thing.
But basically the 200 of them took the Western world by storm.
Yeah.
Some people were repelled by it. Other people were so impressed by his charisma, his personality. It was larger than life. If you can imagine, 6'8".
And he was a tall man.
He was tall. And as you mentioned a bit earlier, he came incognito as Petro Menshkovich.
Yeah, Mikhailovich.
Mikhailovich, sorry. But you know what? A 6'8" man with a little wart on the side of his cheek is hard to miss. So they all knew that this was a Tsar.
I mean, he learned to do everything, and he was fascinated with knowledge. So he learned everything there was to learn about architecture and fashion and statecraft. He even learned how to pull teeth and catch butterflies.
Yeah, and the pulling teeth really scared the heck out of his drunken mob because he wanted to test it on everybody. But he'd built his own ship at a very young age, and he actually set off on the Baltic. He was trying it out because now he had done all the studying, fortification, navigation, shipbuilding, and he nearly died. And he keeps thanking God for the fact that he actually managed to get back to shore.
Sure.
So he was, you know, he was always brave and at the front line of everything that he did.
Yeah, he was absolutely one of the proper Renaissance men of his time. And at that stage, the Enlightenment was just starting to catch on. Mm. And he was one of the forerunners there. His main goal, though, was to drag Russia kicking and screaming into the 1700s and to make it a proper empire rather than just this very backward, very traditional and quite dark religious place.
And it was like that. Everybody walked around in these long robes. There was no sign of any human flesh. You know, everything was covered. And
they didn't even allow music.
No music. Their beards, they had these long beards. It was a dark place. It was very, very traditional. And he actually did drag. When he came back from Europe, he would cut their beards himself.
Yep.
And if anybody that didn't or refused to cut their beards would have to pay a tax.
The beard tax. And then, yeah. And worse, to humiliate them even more, if you'd paid the beard tax, you had to wear a medallion around your neck that said, I have paid the tax. Mm. So a lot of traditional Russians were quite pissed off with him. But it's interesting that he also had, he brought Western dress to Russia, said to them, no more of this long oriental robe stuff.
A corset. So he was dancing with an Austrian princess and he felt this like bone around her hips and he wondered what it was. And she said it was whale bone that they used to build the corsets. And he brought that into Russia. So
I'm sure women were thrilled about that one.
Yeah, 100%. You know that he didn't look at class. He looked at capability.
Yeah, merit. Absolutely.
Merit, 100%.
And that's something he has in common with only a very few of the people that we've covered in Blind History, because merit really was a bit of a swear word. If you were born into a certain position, if you came from a certain rank, you were entitled to things automatically, even if you were like his half-brothers, kind of slow, and not necessarily the best specimen of humanity. It's quite bizarre, though, that he, despite all of this love for the Western world, he really wanted Russia to do well. He wanted, he used to, during the second part of his reign where he was warring with Sweden in the Great Northern War, he used to capture anyone who had skills and kind of absorb them into his empire. If you were a carpenter or you were an engineer, he wanted you in his, in his group. And ultimately a lot of those people helped to drag Russia forward as well.
Also, when he had to go back because there was another revolt, then this is the dark side of his character that came out when he would also be part of the torture. Once again, it was the Streltsy that came up in revolt, and he tortured them. Everything that you possibly do to them, they did.
Horrible.
They cut their noses off and he's let them go, so to show that they were the ones that had revolted. And people were lying sparked or hanged all over Moscow at that time. So that was the darker side, where he didn't have patience for anybody that was going to go against what he wants to achieve. And I think his biggest fear, he didn't want his legacy, somebody to be turning around what he'd already gone all the way to do.
Yeah.
And I think Catherine the Great, much later on, she married his grandson. She kept that legacy going, which is great. I think he would have been happy, you know, that's what had happened.
Well, Anthony and I were talking in the preparation of this episode about how strong these Romanov women were. These women were extraordinary. The men, with the exception of Peter, were pretty weak. And I think Russia owes a lot to its great Romanov women. His eventual wife, Catherine the First, his daughter by his second wife, Elizabeth of Russia, and then later on, as you mentioned, Catherine the Second, who, while she wasn't a Romanov by birth, married into them, and we know about her from a previous episode, and his mother, frankly.
Yeah.
These women were instrumental in making Russia the great nation that it became. But his son, an eldest child, his heir, was suspected of being involved in a plot. And he was tried. He confessed under torture, which his father was party to. During questioning, he was convicted and sentenced and executed by his dad with not a single pang of guilt. So when you talk about the dark side of Peter the Great, I mean, imagine doing this to your eldest son. And 100%. This poor child, I mean, he was really just... He was just a bit of a lazy nobody. He really wasn't a huge threat to Peter, but there was no room for forgiveness.
Yeah.
If you let him down, you were finished.
Yeah, he didn't toe the party line, so to speak. And then he ran away. That really.
He ran to the Austrian court and embarrassed Peter. Yeah. But also, Peter's first wife, Eudoxia, also didn't have a very happy time. He didn't like her. She was chosen by his mother. She was dragged from her home. She was tried on false charges of adultery. She was publicly whipped and finally was sent to a monastery in some forlorn part of Russia, too. Yeah. And eventually brought back by his grandson, Peter's grandson. Mm. So... Not great with family.
That was his greatest skill. And I think that's why there was a bit of nervous laughter when he was in France and he picked up the then-to-be king.
The Dauphin.
Yeah, exactly.
Louis
the 15th. He tossed him up in the air, and you must know, from 6'8", how high is already.
Yeah.
And people were getting a bit nervous, and he probably had a few vodkas down him already.
So to summarize, not great with family. Eventually came to the throne after all kinds of machinations. obsessed with ships and the navy, made his country into a formidable empire, and started dressing like a Westerner rather than like these dark boyars with the long beard and the funny hats and fur.
The dark side killed his son.
Yeah.
And didn't establish a proper heir.
And drank too much and had eventually died at 52 years old of a urinary tract.
Yes.
Although they did say that the reason he died was quite heroic. They say that he and his army were marching north and they came upon a lake where there was a ship that was sinking and the sailors were drowning.
Mm.
And he swam out despite his infection to save some of them. I mean, it does sound a little bit like it could be made up, but who knows? This is how he eventually died of a chill, and not before making his wife empress.
That wasn't unusual, because his hero, William of Orange, his wife, Mary, and Mary was granddaughter of, or the daughter of James II.
James II of England.
Well, they were equally ruling.
Yes.
And so he was happier. It suited perfectly.
Well, he didn't mind ruling with his half-brother as well. So
yeah.
He wasn't, you couldn't call him a power-hungry egomaniac like you could other great rulers in history. This guy was happy to not have the limelight, as you said, but did eventually bring the limelight to Russia.
Yeah, the ultimate autocrat.
There we go. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. While he was in England, he and his crew used to drink so much at the same old pub with a whole lot of English noblemen that eventually the pub owner called it Tsar of Muscovy. And there's still a Muscovy Street in London, which is named
after... That's amazing. That's the first I heard of drinking. That's incredible.
That's quite something. Cliffcentral.com